Hi, this is Azimuth World Foundation's podcast, Connecting the Dots. With the help of our guests, we will be connecting the dots between matters of access to public health and safe water and the balance between humankind and nature among indigenous and rural communities.
Hello and welcome to Connecting the Dots. I'm Mariana Marx and I'll be your host for today's episode. Through our support of Indigenous-led projects in Africa's Great Lakes region and through past conversations on this podcast, Azimuth World Foundation has been trying to shed light on the many instances of forced displacement faced by Indigenous communities in the name of conservation, resource extraction, or tourism. Communities we have supported, such as the Batwa or the Enderoys, thrive in their ancestral lands until they were pushed out without free, prior, and informed consent. These communities facing deep-rooted marginalization and the consequences of climate change, for which they bear the least responsibility, as we know, continue to fight for their survival and the preservation of their ways of life, rich cultures, and unique, far-reaching knowledge. In the highland forests of central Kenya, the Ogiek thrived as hunter-gatherers for centuries. But from the colonial era to the present day, they have faced wave upon wave of encroachment into the ancestral lands they have stewarded for so long. This has posed enormous challenges to their survival and well-being. Still, their fight for recognition and for the fulfillment of their rights has been a source of immense inspiration for Indigenous communities worldwide. Today, we are joined by Daniel Kobe, the Executive Director of the Ogiek People's Development Program, who has played a pivotal role in the legal case brought to the African Court on Human and People's Rights, demanding justice for the abuses committed by the Kenyan government against the Ogiek. The outcome of this legal battle constitutes a historical landmark, not only for the Ogiek, but for all the Indigenous communities in Africa facing displacement and forced eviction. Through his organization, he has also overseen numerous projects benefiting the Ogiek communities in the areas such as corporate governance and institutional capacity, education, culture, language, land rights, natural resources, environmental conservation, and climate justice. Daniel has extensive experience participating in international advocacy and decision-making forums, establishing international alliances, and contributing meaningfully towards a robust and impactful worldwide Indigenous rights movement. Daniel Kobe, welcome to Connecting the Dots, and thank you so much for joining us today here. Before we dive into the many challenges faced by the Ogiek due to intruders into their ancestral lands and like forced eviction, could you give our audience an overview of the Ogiek communities and their thriving life in the forest? Where do they come from and where do they live currently? And what are some of the characteristics of their traditional lifestyle?
Thank you very much, connecting the dots. From Ogiek, I tell you that the Ogiek community have registered at 52,000 people. And as per 2019 census, and as a community, we feel we are the owners of Mau Forest Complex. As by 1000 AD, we say that historian says we migrated all the way from the coastal region of Kenya, and we came through the forest, all the forest, but and in the process we got some of us getting assimilated on the way. That's why our numbers are not as big as the other communities. Mm-hmm. And as the opening of the forest by agricultural people, by the pastoralist and the rest, our community started moving and they ended up in Mau Forest Complex, where we are talking about 400,000 hectares of land. And then some of our communities are in Mount Elgon, the western side of Kenya. Within Mau Forest Complex, we have six counties where the Ogiek are: Nakuru, Narok, Kericho, Baringo, Uasin Gishu, and Nandi. And then some of those of us who are in the western side are in Bungoma, in Jepkitale. And I had the privilege of having grown within the Mau Forest Complex. And I worked both as a boy going to school, and also a boy who enjoyed hunting and collecting berries in the forest. we used to go and remove the honey, especially for us. We have that nostalgia of having the stingless bees, which was easy for us because we could not sting. Unfortunately, as I'm talking, the stingless bees are becoming almost extinct in Kenya because of either over-exploitation or because of the destruction of the forest and by those who are intruders, loggers, people who are against whatever. The forest is everything for our tradition, for the way we used to do ceremonies, traditional ceremony, traditional weddings, shaving of children when they have been given birth. And also when we are doing all kinds of initiation from boyhood to manhood, I used to tell people our forest is like a supermarket because that's where we get everything, the medicine, the food, the shell, the material for building homes, that kind of affinity and closeness with the forest with all what we had. We enjoy the nice environment. They enjoy the clean water because from the streams, because there were very minimal pollution by that time. So as an object, we didn't know one day somebody will wake up and say, you have to move. We didn't know one day somebody will say, "You are the boundaries of this land is not the right boundaries. That it is not supposed to be here, but somewhere else." So that leads us to the situation. A lot can be said about Mau Forest Complex, our home, everywhere, the future of Ogiek community.
Thank you, Daniel. Since the onset of the colonial era, the Ogiek and other hunter-gatherers peoples in Kenya have been victims of this dispossession and eviction from their ancestral lands. Daniel, can you tell us about this history, the different motivations behind it, and how it culminated? I believe it was in 2009 with the government issuing a 30-day eviction notice to the Ogiek in the Mau Forest.
There's been a lot about eviction, and I call it it was perennial eviction among the Ogiek community. They kept being evicted from the colonial government. When the colonial government, from the time of Land Charter Commission of 1933-1934, they say that the Ogiek should be assimilated to other communities because their numbers are small. That was the vast and the most memorable evictions, which started by telling the Ogiek, let them get assimilated, because it was meant to pave way for white settlers in what we call white islands. And then the others came up, the post-independent eviction, which started when the government wants to do things like they want to settle their political aligned people in Mau. The Ogiek are removed. And then again, the so-called, we want to do conservation, which has been the greatest drivers, which has been used as a weapon to remove Ogiek in the ancestral home in Mau Forest Complex. This led to Ogiek feeling that they have nowhere to go. In fact, early 1990s, they started with also all sorts of derogative names, calling us dorobos, meaning people without cattle. So they used to tell, those are dorobos, poor people without cattle. They measured wealth in terms of cattle, in terms of the amount of grain, amount of crops you have, but the Ogiek never had all those things. 1992, the late President Moi decided that he wanted to carve part of the forest to the Ogiek community because there was an outcry that the Ogiek have no permanent settlement. They only stay in the forest and became workers with the Kenya Forest Service. So after that, we realized after Moi giving us that piece of land, other non-Ogiek moved in big numbers, and they occupied a lot of land which belongs to Ogiek. This led to Ogiek in 1997. They went to the High Court in Nairobi, and they got their case, and the government stopped further transaction, further demarcation of Mau. But the government, again later, denounced or did not comply with the court. So they kept dishing out part of the land which belongs to Ogiek to settlers. And then in the other part, they say conservation. In the other part, they are giving it for agriculture. and in all sorts of industries. And then in another part, they say they want to start a dam and such like. Mm-hmm. And the court stayed for almost 12 years going to Nairobi. Sometimes we are told the court that the judge is sick, the file is missing. All these are happening. That's why your case cannot be heard. So it kept being deferred. But later on, in 2009, that is when I started personally getting hold of this in a higher note. The Kenya Forest Service gave a notice, a 30-day notice, for the Ogiek to move, and the other anybody in Mao to move out of Mao.
Mm-hmm.
By then, we had started OPDP. That was 1999. So I had a lot of link with other civil society organizations. Mm-hmm. Then I called the current permanent secretary for foreign affairs, Dr. Kori Singwe, and called him because by then he was helping the Androids people at the African Commission on Humans and People's Rights. Mm-hmm. I requested him and say, my friend, the Ogiek are in trouble now. It's not only the Androids who are in trouble. The Ogiek are also in trouble. So kindly, can you help? Because otherwise, they will have nowhere to go. So by then, the Ogiek community decided that we go to the African Commission. When he wrote the letter to the commissioners agreed to stop and request the Kenyan government. By then, we had a coalition government led by Raila Odinga, and then the former late president, Mwai Kibaki. So they said, stop any eviction of the Ogiek until and when their case will be heard and determined.
Mm-hmm.
When Korir came back, there was no proper communication. I called the Council of Elders, 50 of them, and asked them to decide, do we continue with the African Commission or we continue with the Nairobi case, which was in Nairobi, 1997 case. The community said, no, I think we pursue the African Commission. Mm-hmm. By then now, we were to do admissibility of the case to see whether the case was admissible before the African Commission. Indeed, it became admissible after the Ogiek had already given me and the Ogiek People Development Program a go-ahead to stand in between the community and the commission. And so that is when I started driving this case before the African Commission. It took us 8 years. Remember, mm-hmm. when we went there, they did the admissibility. The case was taken in, and they requested they give what we call provisional measures, stopping mm-hmm. anything from going on. Those provisional measures were taken in and accepted by the government, and they say that there is a caveat. That caveat was meant to stop any further giving out of land. But in the process, again, there was a lot of logging going on. Kenya Forest mm-hmm. Service were issuing licenses for logging and a lot of things which were going on parallel. 2012, the African Commission decided to forward the case to the African Court because of what we call mass violations. So the mm-hmm. case went to the African Court, and it was sort of admissible, and we started giving affidavits, support, videos, anything to prove our case beyond reasonable doubt. And by 2014, the hearing took place in Addis Ababa. And that time, we went 26 Ogiek, left from 26 to Addis Ababa, and we had our case being heard
mm-hmm.
On 28 and 29 of November 2014. So those 2 days, we had 2 Ogiek, 1 lady and 1 man, being cross-examined, or rather being witnesses. And then we had also an expert witness on that particular case called Dr. Liz Walden. So she also participated and gave an independent view about the existence of Ogiek in Mao, that it is not that the Ogiek went to Mao. They were in Mao. The Kenyan government and the white settlers found the Ogiek in Mao. So they didn't come to Mao. So they should be allowed, because that is their ancestral home. They are not destructive. So the government wanted to prove and say, oh, Ogiek are the one which led to destruction. The court in their judgment in 2017, they say that it is beyond reasonable doubt there was nothing to show that Ogieg were the cause of destruction or were the cause of deforestation of Mao, because it was in clear within the government that the Ogieg community were there and there was nothing which went wrong until the government. I told them, Ogieg do not have power source. They don't have tractors, the bulldozers to cut down and carry trees and have lorries to carry blocks of trees. And so the case continued. In 2015, the government of Kenya, the High Court, the African Court, requested the government of Kenya and the Ogieg community to have what we call amicable settlement, where we could negotiate. But in the process, the government were not ready. They gave us very stringent in issues. One saying, you must have birth certificate, you must register to be an Ogieg. I say, why should you register to be an Ogieg while you are an Ogieg? Why should you have a birth certificate? Personally, I never had a birth certificate until in 1990, when I was flying for the first time. And it was not easy for any Kenyan to get a birth certificate until recently, when that is when it became mandatory for young children to have a birth certificate. Mm-hmm. So you could not subject Ogieg to something which is not workable. And then they say, we don't want a white person to become a lawyer to the Ogieg community. Mm-hmm. They also said they don't want the African Commission to stand in for the Ogieg. But when they realized that, the court said, no, if this is all you wanted, we cannot continue with this back and forth. So we are now going for full judgment. So then 2017, on the 26th May 2017, the Ogieg case was decided in their favor, at least in merit. And they say Ogieg are the ancestor, the indigenous peoples of Kenya. They are the owners of Mao, and that they should not have any repetition for any form of eviction. Unfortunately, they didn't hear that. By then, they withheld what we call reparation. On the 23rd June 2022, we had also a new judgment under reparation, which also was in the favor of the Ogieg community. Somebody was asking me, how do we do it? How did you do it? The fact remained, I had what you call a feedback mechanism, whereby I ensure that the Ogieg community are able to give information. When I receive a letter from the court, from the commission, from the lawyers, I had to have public forums and inform the community. And they keep saying, keep on going, keep on going. Because by then, we never wanted a situation whereby the community are in the dark. They must know that this is their case. It's not Daniel's case. It is the Ogieg case. So we should have that connection. And then one other advantages which I saw during the process was the support of the women. The women are not scared, fortunately. The women are very strong people, strong-willed. They kept supporting us through a lot of motivation. During the meetings, we had nice motivational songs, folk songs from the community telling us to keep fighting for our rights to Mau Forest Complex, because that is where our ancestors are. That is where our ancestors have been buried. We have their connection, and that is where all our life depend upon. So when during the time before the reparation, hearing, there were a lot of delays again from 2017 to 2022. That's 5 years. And that was also another issue, because COVID came in and they started saying, no, we cannot listen to you online. We cannot do, because witnesses will be compromised, which also delayed the whole thing. Now, last year, 2023, after we had started early working with the government, trying to do this and that with the government, on 1st of November, another eviction came in. And this was also orchestrated by the fact that there was what you call, I think, African Climate Summit, And they say that they want to show a lot. Kenya want to become champions in protecting the forest. And I think the president said everybody to move. And some of our communities in a place called Sasimwani, 700 were removed. As I'm talking, those people are landless. Mm-hmm. They are out. They need food. They need shelter. They went and hired small rooms in a center called Ologirirai. But as I'm talking, their children are out of school. They don't know what to do. And in the process, the people came and said, there is a plan for carbon market and carbon credit. Then we said, what is it about it? We do not know, because the issue of carbon, and then people, other guys doing pollution, and then you are trying to sanitize or trying to help, is some of the things which we found not very interesting. So as I'm talking, there's been very little as far as implementation of the Ogier case, but in the process, but only we have been subjected to other challenges.
And Daniel, but what do you think is necessary for the decision of the African Court to be implemented on the ground, since, you know, it was established before that that shouldn't been happening? And then, as you just described, 2023, November 1st, eviction came, you know, houses were teared down, fire also burning your houses, your livelihoods. So what do you think it's, you know, needs to happen?
Really, I can say, Mariana, it is something which is terrible, because one of the cases was saying there should be a compensation of 157,800,000 to the Ogier community. And they said, yes, we can pay, but the Attorney General has not given us a go-ahead. Why can't the Attorney General take up his responsibility? But in the end of the day, everything, the buck stops with the president. It is the president of Kenya to marshal his team and tell them to implement the Ogier case. We are only telling the international community to support the Ogier, and those who have networks or have a voice with the Kenyan government to speak to them and tell them that it is important that you give a chance to the Ogier to be back home and implement the Ogier case to the letter, and ensure that you protect them from any sorts of violation. As at now, they should also have confidence that the Ogier community are good in protecting the forest. So they should not be denied the role of protection and conservation of the forest, because they know it. It is their tradition. So the traditional knowledge by the Ogier community in conservation should be utilized and be given a chance.
It's, you know, many experts have pointed out that this latest eviction that you just referred in November 2023 was likely undertaken to ensure that the Kenyan government has authority over land that will be incorporated into these carbon markets. We also know that the Kenyan government recently signed a significant offsetting deal with Blue Carbon, for example. And all of this is happening while indigenous peoples are increasingly recognized internationally as the most effective stewards of forest ecosystems and biodiversity. Can you tell us what the case of the Ogier community can teach to the world about these perils posed by these false climate solutions that are showing up all the time, and how are also indigenous communities particularly vulnerable to these green transition solutions that overlook human rights?
So this is a forced climate solution. So the community are being forced to accept some solution about climate which are not favorable to their lifestyles. And the other community is that all the plans which are going on without any consultation, even free or informed consent, or rather even benefit sharing from anything even accrued from the so-called carbon credit and the rest. But I can tell the world that when you see this information, these issues coming up in the name of climate solutions or climate change, be very careful, because it might mean it might cost your land and territories. Because most of the areas which are being targeted are indigenous people's lands and territories. So this means the indigenous peoples and local communities must be vigilant about their land. Otherwise, they might be subject to climate forced solution, as we have witnessed as Ogiya community.
Thank you, Daniel. And you also face one of the other obstacles that you, your community faced, the Ogiek, has been the refusal of the Kenyan government to recognize you as indigenous peoples. Can you tell us about the impacts of this government policy on the Ogiek and their visibility and acknowledgement by other Kenyans?
The current constitution, it has a very small part talking about indigenous peoples. And they describe indigenous people as those who are historically hunters and gatherers or pastoralists. That is how they describe. So the other communities still believe they are indigenous people, but they say, why should they be given special privileges? Like, we are not as educated as the other communities. We still lack backward in other things. So there's no way we can be in the same power. And despite the fact that African Commission on Human and People's Rights Working Group came up with a list of who are indigenous peoples in Kenya, but the governments have not really taken it up and say, these are the indigenous peoples of Kenya and they should be protected.
Where do you think, how do you think the youth is dealing with that as well? I know you work quite closely with the youth. So
yes, yes.
How do they envision their future in the communities?
Most youths are now pushing for knowledge, and in other words, for them to learn more about technology. And very few of them are really interested to fight for the indigenous way of living. So because they have been deprived from understanding their cultures. They've been deprived to know that we are different from the rest. So is that issue of saying we are equal, we are the same, but the communities continue suffering. The young, what we have been doing as Ogiek, we have been having even language recording for the youths. We are teaching the old people on how to read and write, because we have a lot of our people who do not know how to read and write. So we have started in our center, and then those who have also lost the language, they are no longer speaking Ogiek language. We are also trying to teach them on how to speak Ogiek language, so that they are on board. Because those who are interested in knowing the Ogiek language, in knowing some of the cultures, they can easily come to our defense. But when you are not even interested in knowing the language, knowing the culture, then you are already done and fully assimilated. In fact, what we have done, Mariana, we have even gone ahead and started writing in Ogiek language. And we gave youths to do competition. This makes the youth to be more interested in learning a lot about the Ogiek, because it's being written, it's being spoken. Some young women have started now doing poetry, giving poems in Ogiek language.
And you also have the music as well, right, which is important.
Yes, very, very. In fact, music is a key in trying to promote the Ogiek, the Ogiek language as well.
Can you tell us now, talking a little bit about, you know, your organization, can you tell us more about the history, you know, focus areas and main projects taken by the Ogiek People's Development Program? What are your main achievements at the moment for your organization?
Some of our milestones is really leading the community to the achieving the two landmark ruling. One, we have also done rehabilitation of the destroyed forest. You may not believe it, we have already planted 1.6 million indigenous trees in Mau. From 2016, they are now big trees. This year alone, we were able to start working with some partners, and we've started planting again indigenous trees close to 20,000, which we are targeting by next year, we should have reached 80,000. We are working as a tripartite with the community, OPDP, and the Kenya Forest Service to rehabilitate Mau Forest Complex. Because even though we are fighting for the rights of land, we don't want to get a bare land. We need our land to be having forest so that we are able to do. We also started other projects like solar panels. We've been able to give solar panels to more than 100 families. Some of the challenges we have in the villages is that there is no electricity. They have never seen power. With our partners, we started giving those vulnerable families solar panels. And we also managed to come up with the Ogie Cultural Center, which is one of the big successes for PDP, because we are talking of a project which is almost over 250,000 Kenya USD. And that's not a small, in Kenya, that's not a small amount of money to build a center. And which is within 5-acre land, which we actually acquired because we could not get any time we wanted to establish the center. The Kenya Forest Service was having a problem with us. And it is a center now. It has a museum. It has a herbarium where we teach young people, those who are interested in learning herbal medicine. Because many people got interested in herbal medicine after COVID. We are also working with some of our people in partners, and we have established, right now, so we are talking, we got scholarship from Form 1 to Form 4, 24 gear girls because of early marriages and pregnancies and such like. And above all, we have established a very concrete women livelihood projects where women are taking the right small proposal. We give them grants so that they are able to have their own income. And this has also worked well. And a lot of our women are now got their own income through some of the projects. Some of them, they hire tents. Some we give them sheep, some we give them cows, and all this just for their livelihood support. Mm-hmm. Because I usually tell them, people cannot eat human rights. You cannot tell people human rights. They will tell you, yes, I've heard about human rights, but what am I going to eat? Where's food in the table and all that? So we are also trying to establish as much and give chances to the youths and the women to do livelihood projects. So we have also established a lot of networks among the hunter-gatherers in Kenya, six communities, the Yaku, the Sengwe, the Ogiwomon, Elgon, the Awer, the Wayu, the Wata. All these are hunter-gatherer communities. And also we work with networks in Africa where we are hosting International Land Coalition, what we call under the regional platform on indigenous people and territories in Africa, where we as OPDP, we are hosting and we are working with 15 countries in Africa. So we are having very close working relations with many organizations in Kenya who are also working with other international partners.
Yeah, very, very impressive, Daniel. Share with us what makes indigenous-led organizations and projects so effective, like many that you just described, and why should these organizations, indigenous-led organizations, receive more direct funding?
Well, let me talk from my personal experience, because I've been in the movement for almost 25 years. There reached a time when, during my work, I used to be supported by other non-Indigenous organizations. And at reached a time I said no. I told some partners, if you are not giving support directly to us, stay with your money. Because sometimes we are subjected to things which does not make sense to us. But when it is from us, it is, we will use it for the benefit of our communities. But when it comes through others, they will give back the administration, take some money for audit, some money. By the time it reaches you, it's very little money, which does not create any impact. But when you support indigenous peoples themselves, they will do, and you see the product. And most of them, like in OPDP right now, my organization, we are getting a lot of trust from many international organizations who wants to support us. And self-governance is just like self-determination. The moment you give us, you are actually giving ourselves our own self-determination, that we can do our things our way and have the confidence. And also we will be able to create our own governance structures.
Mm-hmm.
So I personally am now coordinating a fund for emergency fund, and which is called Indigenous-Led Security Fund. I'm one of the coordinators, and it is purely indigenous people leading it to support those, what we call environmental defenders. We have also started what we call indigenous-led research, whereby the research is led by indigenous people themselves. And currently we are working with other organizations to develop a model, or rather on how to do research. We are trying to develop a research on how to domesticate hyrax. Hyrax is one of the animals which are favorable, have a lot of connectivity with Ogiek, because part of the dressing regalia by the Ogiek is made of hyrax skin. So if it gets extinct, then nobody will ever know how we were making our regalia or our dresses, because we are using the skin from the hyrax. And even other ways, like now, we need to tell people on how to do restoration. When were you to cut? Which tree were you to cut? You cannot cut a very fresh tree. You wait for a tree which has died off so that you can use it for firewood. So if you give them this kind of open space, I think we can also lead a very big grant like any other organization, given a chance.
Daniel, thank you so much for taking the time to speak with us today. It is really a privilege to hear your testimony, learn about the Ogiek. We also leave this conversation more inspired by the work that your organization, the Ogiek People's Development Program, is doing, because it truly exemplifies how Indigenous-led organizations and projects are essential to achieving a world with more empathy, justice, respect for both the natural world and human rights. To our listeners, we urge you to follow the Ogiek People's Development Program on their website and social media channels. Thank you for joining us once again. If you like this interview, please share it with your family, with your friends. Podcast, video, and written versions are available, both languages, English and Portuguese, at azimuthworldfoundation.org/insights. Let's keep growing our alliances and supporting the advancement of Indigenous rights. Thank you, and see you soon.
Thank you so much. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to Connecting the Dots, an Azimuth World Foundation podcast. Join the conversation on our website, azimuthworldfoundation.org, or by following us on Instagram, Twitter, Facebook, or LinkedIn.